Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. We're continuing our conversation with Casey's book on the 100 most important events in church history. So we're going to talk a little bit about the Word of Wisdom. Is the LDS view of the Word of Wisdom more similar or less than the Community of Christ's observance of the Word of Wisdom? Dr. Casey Griffiths is going to answer that, and we'll talk more about that, as well as how the LDS Church has turned from a regional church into a global organization. We're also going to be giving away a copy of 50 Relics of the Restoration, Casey's newest book. And so if you'd like to sign up to win this, I'm going to be giving it away in Episode 8 here shortly. So sign up at gospeltangents.com/Casey, that's C-A-S-E-Y, if you'd like a chance to win this fantastic book. It's a signed autographed copy, by the way. So now back to our conversation.
Another example might be the way that Community of Christ sees the Word of Wisdom. They follow much more closely kind of the version of the Word of Wisdom that Joseph Smith would have followed, to where coffee and tea, you know, aren't that really big a deal.
I know Bill Russell has said, all you got to do is let it cool and it's not a hot drink anymore.
Yeah, I love Bill too. He's hilarious.
Yeah.
He makes me laugh.
But
to see how their interpretation of the Word of Wisdom changed, I mean, you can't really understand the way we live the Word of Wisdom unless you know who Heber J. Graham is. Heber J. Graham is the person that really makes the Word of Wisdom a signature component of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I mean, even Brigham Young. Brigham Young comes along after Joseph Smith and says, all right, this isn't just a suggestion now. This is a commandment. And when I want to shake my students up in class, I show them this entry in Joseph Smith's journal where he's like, I went and got a beer with Brother so-and-so. And my students are like, oh, no, because they see Joseph Smith as like a Latter-day Saint exactly the same way we are today. Well, Brigham Young gets up and says, we've had 20 years. I think we can move this from suggestion to commandment, but he doesn't put any consequences in. Like, well, if you don't do it, we're not going to do anything to you.
You can still go to the temple.
You can still go to the temple, for instance. So
in fact,
it's kind of like...
I want to say I saw a picture of the Salt Lake Temple. Was it the Celestial Room? That had spittoons.
Yeah, and Brigham Young used chewing tobacco. Like, as I understand it, he eventually kicked the habit, but it helped him with pain in his teeth, you know?
Didn't it cause the pain in his teeth?
I guess he had bad teeth and tobacco assuaged it. There's one story where Brigham Young used to keep a swatch of tobacco in his pocket and pull it out and go, who's stronger, me or you? And then put it back in. But at any rate, the Word of Wisdom in Brigham Young's time and John Taylor and so on was kind of like the way, you know, ministering is now. Like, we all know it's a good thing and that we should do it. But if a person doesn't do it, there's not really any consequences. The Word of Wisdom was like that until Heber J. Grant says, if you want to go to the temple, you have to live the Word of Wisdom. And this is what the Word of Wisdom means. And it's that point.
Wasn't that a reaction to Utah overturning Prohibition?
No, it happened around the same time that Prohibition came into effect. So it's the early 1920s when Prohibition goes over the entire United States that Heber J. Grant makes observance of the Word of Wisdom a requirement.
I thought it was at the end.
Yeah, Heber J. Grant is pretty political as well, and he was very strongly in favor of Prohibition. But it happens concurrent with Prohibition, not as a reaction to the end of Prohibition. Hmm. Heber J. Grant is mad when Prohibition ends. Utah, I think, was the state that voted to end
yes.
Prohibition, and Heber J. Grant was like, you guys have ignored me.
See, I could swear that the story that I heard about Heber J. Grant was it wasn't a temple requirement. The Word of Wisdom wasn't a temple requirement until Utah overturned Prohibition. So is that not a true story?
It's not a true story. As I understand it, it's in the 1920s. It's almost immediately after he becomes president of the church. That Heber J. Grant felt really strongly about the Word of Wisdom.
Right.
And he, almost immediately after he became president of the church. Now, we also might put too much pressure on President Grant as well. There's indications that Joseph F. Smith also had started to turn the pressure up on the Word of Wisdom a little bit. We have records, for instance, that, you know, he told a bishop that was drinking that if he didn't clean up his act, you know, he would be removed as bishop. And Joseph F. Smith also is the person that changes the practice from using wine in sacrament practices to using water. And that is linked to the Word of Wisdom as well.
Oh, I thought water was much earlier than that. Really?
No, it was really the early 1900s. The date, and I might be wrong here, is 1906, I think, when it becomes... It's not uniform across the church, but around that time is when the first presidency and the 12 start using water instead of wine in their sacrament, and they set the tone, right? And so it becomes common then. So we've known since Section 27 was given in 1830 that you could use other things, but we did typically use wine until... And that's been another interesting aspect of exploring these different things. I visited a little church called the House of Aaron that's a breakoff from our church.
Oh, I've met somebody from there.
Oh, the House of Aaron, that's a whole other six-hour conversation. But they use wine in their sacraments.
There was a guy named Stevenson that I met at the Remnant Church in Independence.
Yeah, they have connections to the Remnant Church. Again, there's this whole web. But I've been out there and hung out with them, and I wrote a paper on them.
Because they do consecration.
Yeah, they still live the law of consecration at a place called Eskdale. You and I need to go to Eskdale.
We do need to go to Eskdale.
I love Eskdale. At any rate, yeah, Heber J. Grant is the person that finally, I think, just puts the hammer down. But there's pressure from Brigham Young all the way up to making the Word of Wisdom more than just a suggestion, making it more of a commandment. Now, in Community of Christ, in the RLDS tradition, as I understand it, that pressure doesn't exist quite as much. And so their observance of the Word of Wisdom, ironically, is probably closer to what Joseph Smith did than what we do today. But it does show, like I said, that there's other people in the church besides Joseph Smith that affect the course of the history of the church. We don't always take into account the fact that there were no proxy sealings or endowments that Joseph Smith did. Brigham Young is the person that implements that practice. The St. George's Temple is where those ordinances are performed for the first time.
I thought that was Wilford Woodruff.
Wilford Woodruff is president of the St. George's Temple.
Yes.
When they implement
that. But that was under Brigham Young.
Brigham Young's president of the church while they're building it. And Brigham Young is the one. Brigham Young and Wilford Woodruff together that kind of say, if we do baptisms and confirmations for the dead, we also have to do endowments and sealings for the dead, which we don't think about moves endowments and sealings from a nice thing to an essential ordinance. Like I said, they're sitting there thinking about it, and they basically implement that. That's a Brigham Young thing. Church correlation, which is the thing that comes about when President McKay is there, is a huge thing that we don't often think about or realize. In our conversations with Community of Christ, for instance, sometimes it's really difficult to pin down exactly what they believe on a given subject.
Well, I'm trying to remember, because the last time I talked to Locke was about 3 years ago, I believe, and he said they were thinking about making the Word of Wisdom a little bit more strict for leaders, but leave it alone as is for members.
Yeah. Well, that goes back to correlation, right? Is that the Community of Christ has a less strict correlation system. They did try something that sort of blew up and didn't work out that well. But our correlation system makes it so that if you're an active member of the church in the United States and an active member of the church in Thailand, you pretty much have the same understanding of what the Word of Wisdom means. That is rare in the religious world, I'll just say. That a uniformity of belief, the kind of which Latter-day Saints have across the board, is rare. And it comes at a cost in some senses, too. There's some things that are correlated that maybe don't need to be, but on the whole, correlation has given us kind of this unified expectation. And church members will often get up and say, hey, I went to church in this foreign country, and it was cool to see them studying out of the same manuals as us. And yes, that's great. At the same time, too, there's some question as to when we say the church is globalizing, how much do we give? Like, another facet of my research that we wanted to put into this book was the transition from a regional American religion to a global faith. And one of the major questions that the correlation movement had to ask was, what is the gospel? Like, what's American culture and what is the gospel? And to what boundary do we cross over the two? For instance, I have a friend who works in educational groups in Africa. And in Africa, the idea that a husband and wife would kiss in public, in certain parts of Africa, is just taboo. It's pornographic. Like, they would see it as,
oh, really?
As terrible. Yeah. And he told this story where this local American leader of the church was worried that the husbands and wives weren't expressing enough affection. And so he held the fireside, and he brought his wife up front, and he gave her a big kiss in front of the congregation and said, I want all of you to do this. And the entire congregation was just sitting there, like, horrified. Like, how can we do this? Well, we'd have to go back to the earlier question of, is kissing your wife in public a facet of the gospel? It's really not, right? It's something that is part of American culture, and in America is a good way of expressing your affection and love for your spouse, but it's not necessarily something that we have to transfer somewhere else. Now, other things like the atonement, repentance, the Book of Mormon, we do have to transfer from cultures, and if they come into conflict, we have to deal with that. But there's a lot of leeway, and church leaders have been negotiating this boundary for a really long time as to what's gospel culture and what isn't gospel culture.
See, that brings up an interesting thing. I was just listening to a podcast with Patrick Mason, and he was talking a little bit about correlation as well, and he talked about drums. In America, drums are terrible, and they're not reverent, and we would never, ever think of them as being in a church meeting. But in Africa, drums are considered sacred. And we've Americanized Africa, so, and we don't allow drums. And he's like, shouldn't we give a little bit more leeway on that?
Yeah, and like I said, I'm not second-guessing church leaders. President Kimball especially led a movement called Reduce and Simplify, where he was trying to say, hey, a lot of the stuff that we're exporting to members of the church outside of the United States isn't stuff that is the gospel.
Because they can't afford an organ.
Yeah, yeah. And I served as a curriculum writer for the church, and honestly, one of the big questions was, would this make sense to a person in Mongolia? We were always supposed to ask ourselves that. Our leaders would always say, hey, the average seminary teacher in the church is a three-year convert that's in their 20s. Are you writing for that person, or are you writing for an American person that's raised in the church?
With a bachelor's degree.
With a bachelor's degree and all that stuff. So if you wrote in like a football story, you had to take into account that a person in another country might think football is something totally different.
Soccer.
Than you think it is, yeah. you'll note that in General Conference, general authorities are going out of their way to say, during the American Civil War, and things like that, to differentiate for international members of the church. And we've got a ways to go there, but that's another facet that we wanted to cover in this book was a lot of our history, two of the biases that we have are one, that everything is American. You know, all our history is Palmyra, Nauvoo, and Salt Lake City. We need to start talking about Bangkok and Tokyo and Johannesburg. We've got to start internationalizing the church and telling more stories that are from out there. And I think the church is really trying to do this. There's some very robust global history that's been put up on their site. Saints, as it progresses, is doing better and better, bringing in global history. I was really encouraged that a significant portion of Saints Volume 2, for instance, doesn't take place in America. It takes place in Tahiti and in Europe and a bunch of different places.
Right.
And the other major bias is it's male. And I know everybody gets sick of hearing that, but we one of the advantages we have of describing our dispensation is an abundance of female sources. We have a ton of women that had experience with the Restoration and whose stories we need to be telling. So it's no coincidence that on both these books I had a co-author, co-authors that was female. And one of the things I was grateful to Susan and Mary Jane for was they were always saying, what's a woman's angle we can talk about here? Like Mary Jane was the person that found out about the temple swimsuit, first of all. but one of the objects we include in the book is a baby blessing dress. The baby blessing dress used for Leah Widsoe. Now, Leah Widsoe's fairly well known. She's the wife of John A. Widsoe. She's super smart. She writes a couple books with John A. Widsoe. But the backstory with Leah Widsoe is that she is also the daughter of Sousa Young Gates, who's Brigham Young's daughter, kind of like his rebellious... She's not rebellious, but she's kind of a mismatch for her time. Like, Sousa Young Gates feels really strong. She writes this big thing about, I wish I was a man. Like, she wants to be educated. She wants to be a dynamic leader.
Like Taylor Swift.
She feels limited by the society that she's in. Well, Sousa Young Gates is also the daughter of Brigham Young. And you can imagine the pressure coming from not just being the daughter of the president of the church, but being the daughter of Brigham Young. She gets married. Her first marriage is a disaster. You know, the guy is a drinker. He's abusive. she gets a divorce. Now imagine the stigma with not only being the daughter of the prophet, but now being the divorced daughter of the prophet in the 19th century. Leah is...
Well, Brigham got a divorce.
Brigham got a divorce. That's the other thing. We actually include a cancellation of sealing certificate in our objects book because it gave us a chance to talk about divorce. Most people might be surprised to know that in the 19th century, divorce was more common among Latter-day Saints.
It really was.
Than the American public at large. But it was partially because the way that we administered plural marriage gave a lot of leeway to women that felt uncomfortable with the system or entered into a plural marriage and then decided they didn't want to. They generally grant that. Well, Sousa is one of these people. She has this baby, and the husband takes custody of the baby, Leah. And so including that baby blessing dress was a way of telling the story of this mother and this daughter and the society that they lived in and the pressures that they faced and how they overcame them. Sousa eventually becomes known as like the 13th apostle because she writes and teaches so much and is just kind of, she's sort of the Sherry Dew of her, you know, age. She's just seen as this dynamic female figure. And Leah, to a certain extent, takes up that banner as well. And progresses on. But again, we're trying to find like things that were a big deal that sometimes get left off the table that we don't always kind of think about. And not because we're trying to sweep history under the rug or anything like that, because it doesn't always relate to our life and what's going on with us.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Casey Griffiths. In our next conversation, we're going to talk about early Mormon apostle Orson Pratt. And Casey identifies why I probably like Orson Pratt the most.
And Orson's interested in like the numbers and digits. That's probably another reason why you like Orson Pratt, right? He's a mathematician.
He is.
We tried to put Orson Pratt's telescope into our objects.
Oh, yeah.
As a way of showing how in the 19th century, people like Orson Pratt did not see science as antithetical to religion at all. They saw it as like proof that religion is true.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, sign up at patreon.com/gospeltangents, and for $5 a month, you can hear the entire interview without any interruptions. If you'd like to see the whole video, that's just $8 a month, and you can sign up either at youtube.com/gospeltangents or on our website at gospeltangents.com and click the yellow subscribe button. Or you can go to patreon.com/gospeltangents, and I'll just need to make sure that we're Facebook friends, and I'll add you to our insiders group, and you can see the entire interview uncut. If you'd like to get PDF transcripts of our interviews, those are just $10 a month. And for just $15 a month, I will send you paperback versions of our transcripts as soon as they come out. Or, of course, you can buy them on Amazon as well. Go to Amazon.com and do a search for Gospel Tangents interview, and you can see all of our transcripts there. Don't forget to sign up for our updates at facebook.com/gospeltangents. Of course, you can follow us at Gospel Tangents on Twitter. To hear our interviews updated to your podcast player, go to tinyurl.com/gospeltangents and make sure you give us a 5-star review. And of course, you should show your support for Gospel Tangents with one of these cool t-shirts, like this green one, or light blue, sport gray, royal blue, purple, of course black, beautiful gold, and of course Utah red. I've probably left out some colors, but if you want to see more, go to gospeltangents.com/shop and you can get one of these. So once again, thanks for listening. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here we've got some more of our great videos. Thanks again.